Advanced Bird Language, Reading the Concentric Rings of Nature with John Young.
We're in our gathering this morning. Greg Summer, one of our senior apprentices in the school, offered a Thanksgiving greetings to the ancestors, the ones who carried this knowledge through time, that we might be able to be here today to share it. And I'd just like to second that, and for all of you out there in listening land, to think about that. If it wasn't for the continuing teachings of the native people that made sure their children learned the skills of awareness and the skills of survival all through time, we wouldn't really have this reference point from which to work here today. So I want to remember that. In this particular tape, we're going to look a lot into the native people, their lore, and how they learned this, why they learned it, that sort of thing, in the hopes that you might use this as a role model yourself to imitate, try to pull out some of the same situations for yourself and realize what it takes to really learn this stuff. We use these models a lot in our school today. You've heard me mention the community school a lot in this tape series. That's actually more or less full-time high school in the Pacific Northwest in Washington State, where students come and practice these kinds of routines every day and learn nature and ecology through their secret spot and through exploring the lands around them. We use a lot of these models and we share them in the art of mentoring. So if you're an environmental educator, a teacher, a parent, you might pay particular attention to this tape and think about what it's saying. Read between the lines, try to imitate it, and you'll find that you'll be more successful in mentoring the next generation and learning these skills. So when we look at, again, the ancient scout tradition, I want to think about, what does it mean to be a scout? That is such a foreign idea for us in the modern world today. Maybe if you read The Way of the Scout or if you read the book Grandfather, both of these by Tom Brown Jr., you might get a sense or an insight into what a scout's life is like. It's such a different reality. And just to think about the kinds of things that a scout would regularly experience, you might understand some of the choices that they make in their life. If you can imagine, since childhood, since you're a little tiny kid, you're just thinking about the people in your community, the people in your village, the people that you hear stories about on a regular basis, and how you want to imitate them. You know, what am I going to be when I grow up? You might think back to that time again with me for a minute, or reflect on the kids around you that you see now, how they imitate and pretend. I have a two-year-old boy right now who, having watched Star Wars a bunch, imitates Jedis all the time. He can't even really speak yet, but he certainly speaks with his body and his eyes and his body language, his posture. So you have to think about Native children who are growing up far away from the influences of what we all take for granted. Their only influences are the trees and the bushes, the mountains, the valleys, the stories of their elders, the other children that they observe, the animals that they observe. These are the things that they grow up with, and that's all they're going to imitate. They're going to imitate those people that they see and admire. And Native people are really careful to tell lots of hero stories in a very almost carefully planned manner. The stories that are told around the village fires are the stories of the great heroes that carry all the attributes that would help those children survive into the next generation. So even from birth, maybe even before birth, you know, through the vibrations they hear through the walls of their mother's stomach, that's what they're hearing. So, you know, this is something that's deeply entrenched in them. So by the time they're old enough to be playing fantasy games on their own, where they go off and make little, instead of blanket forts, in their case, they're probably actually making stick forts, but all kids do that. Imagine them out there by themselves making these little stick forts and playing sneak-up games on each other, which, of course, I'm sure you all remember was popular when you were a kid, hide-and-seek and those kinds of things. Although, in the native villages, this was something that they never stopped playing. So imagine the excitement when a scout would come in into the village with a report, having been out of the village maybe for as much as a whole moon cycle, maybe a whole 28 days. He's been out roving around by himself, and he comes back in to bring the messages into the tribe, what's been seen, where the next supply of game is, where the grass is lush and green, where the enemies are camped, what kind of things did they see, what wondrous things did they experience. And in a great ceremony, the scouts were brought into the village. Among the Lakota, Gilbert tells the story of how the scouts would come in and go straight to the lodge of the leaders and the medicine people, where they would do a very special ceremony and offer them a sacred pipe to smoke. And they would smoke that pipe, being told and reminded that whatever words leave their lips at this point must be truth, because only truth can be told after the smoking of the sacred pipe. And from that point on, they would report in very clear, simple terms what it is that they saw and where they've been and that kind of thing. And from there, the village would be gathered and there'd be announcements made. So just think about the children, the excitement and the mystique around the scouts coming in. And the scouts, the legends of the scouts, their ability to disappear right before your eyes, their ability to live without any support. They didn't have shelters with them when they went out scouting. They didn't have food with them. They might carry some dried meat, some pemmican, but for the most part, they were able to live off the land by what they could gather and what they could put together. They were always totally independent. So this is what the children see. So from their youngest days, some of the children in the village are drawn to imitate the scouts. So from their earliest days, they might be asking their grandmothers and grandfathers, how do I become a scout? I want to be a scout one day. The grandfather with wisdom, or the grandmother with wisdom, would know that that means that that child has to be comfortable being alone and has to be comfortable sitting in stillness. And so that child would be inspired through stories and through questioning to adopt a place on the landscape, like a secret spot, and that they would be encouraged to sit alone and to be in the silence. Gilbert Walking Bull was telling us wonderful scout stories recently, and he was telling us that since early childhood, all of the elders, and remember when Gilbert was just a little kid, the elders that were around him were the elders that were young when the people were still hunter-gatherers. So there was a continuous memory, a connection to that time when the people still lived that way. He would tell us that his elders always shushed him, shh, and they'd tell him, huh, huh, listen, listen. And they were always telling him that when he was little. And so around, all the other kids around him were always quiet because they were always being told to listen. He said, but I never knew what I was listening to. But still, I listened. I learned from a young age to silence myself and to always listen. And then when we've wandered out into the bush in the fields with the other children, and I think he said there were something like 12 or 13 kids in the family around him, that he played with regularly, but there was a small band of children that would go off wandering. Each morning when they were sent off into the hills to wander, the grandmother would always tell them, could you please bring us back this herb that grows on this hill? And she would tell them where it was growing and where to find it. So they would wander, but they always had a mission. So it seemed like Grandma, in her gathering of things through the children, sort of introduced them slowly but surely to all the lands around them, and they wandered all around. But Gilbert said even when they wandered together, they never spoke to each other, and that when there were seven of them moving, that you knew where all the other ones were, but they never kind of walked in a group and talked to each other. The way the kids are, I observe today, how they walk through the forest, they're always kind of talking and chiding and joking. But Gilbert was explaining that they were always given the feeling since childhood that the nature was like a cathedral or a special sacred place, that when you walked in it, you never wanted to disturb it. And I remember Tom telling me too, in things, similar things, in the saying, never disturb a singing bird, it's in its Thanksgiving ceremony. That idea is deeply entrenched in the concepts of life of these people from early childhood. So imagine the brain patterning, the thought processes that's developing in the child. who, even when moving in a group of kids, is moving alone. You know, that you can, as Gilbert said, he always knew where the other kids were by the sounds that he could hear, the rustling of the brush, or the sounds the birds were making, or, you know, the startled birds would fly up when the kids walked into that place. But he could, through the landscape, also know where each and every one of those other children was, and if they needed to get together, they could kind of make little sounds and signal each other. But they were taught from a young age never to disturb the tapestry of life around them and to always listen with all their might to what was going on around. And Gilbert explained that eventually that he reached that place of quietness in his mind, one of the seven sacred attributes that he refers to in the development of a natural person, that the quietness of the mind, which Grandfather Stalking Wolf calls the sacred silence, this place where you exist, that these children were reaching it at a very young age, and that they were also holding on to it and maintaining it. So think about that child as that child grows up. And maybe that one child eventually becomes a scout. And in order to become a scout, having to have mastered all of their physical skills, all of their ability to get fire on their own, all of their ability to make traps and to track, not only to procure food for themselves, but also to be able to read the health and vitality of the game herds and the numbers of animals in an area, to be able to tell from the landscape in a brief glance if there was enough medicine and food for their people to survive in that particular region. They had to be taught to be the most amazing naturalists, really, is what I look at it that way. Their minds became the land from all of their study. And this was so much, you know, what generated the scout tradition. But if you think about it, almost all of the kids in the village were growing up with that kind of knowledge. They had to. They had to have not at least the basic knowledge of the plants and animals and trees and birds around them. But there was those among them that were very, very specially gifted to become scouts. And they talk about the scouts as if it was a calling. They refer to that path almost in the same way that I remember growing up as a Catholic, the calling to become a priest. It was very similar, that these people had this very deep spiritual calling to walk a life alone in closeness to the creation and to the Creator that moves in all things. And so the scout tradition was a very kind of highly revered and special place. So the children who grew up to be scouts, by the time they were old enough to become a scout, had already assimilated such an amazing knowledge of land and skills. They practiced the highest skills of awareness that a person could possibly practice. They knew all of the kinds of things that this tape series talked about, and they knew a whole lot more than this tape series could talk about, because, you know, as much as I would love to be a scout, I haven't lived that life. It hasn't been a full-time occupation for me. You know, it's been my deepest passion to learn these skills and to understand the ways of the scout, but I never lived that way. You know, only on a weekend here or a week there. But these people did it 24/7, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all through their life. And the thing was that they didn't just, you know, do it recreationally. They did this because if they didn't do it, their people could be destroyed. You know, they could die. And the responsibility that rested on the scout's shoulders to make the most crucial judgments on behalf of the people's health and happiness, the weight of that was so great. So you can imagine the depth of thought and the depths of commitment that went into each and every observation, each and every, you know, data bit collected from the landscape, and how all that was put together. You know, it was very, very, let's just say the need was so great to do it right. You know, and when I look at the way we mentor children today in our school, we're always looking at ways to increase that need for those kids, the same thing, because it seems to me that the greatest teacher of all is need itself. You know, as Tom Brown likes to say today too, that need is essentially equivalent to results. You know, the greater the need, the greater the results will be from anything that you undertake. You know, and he applies that to all of these skills. Remember that scouts had the greatest need. So having said that, you know, admitting my own weakness in that manner, I've never had this great need other than the need, you know, placed on me by Tom's Coyote teaching ability to really accomplish these skills to the high degree that the scouts did. And I look at the next generation of students that we're raising through our school, I see that we've been much better at creating that need for them. Because what took me 7 years to learn, I see them doing it in 2.5 years now. And that excites me, to know that we, as a school, has learned enough about the cultural effects of native lifestyles that cause need to increase. You know, it sort of happens by accident or indirectly. It's not something that, it's not like a lesson plan. You know, lesson plans can figure into this, but it's the cultural setting that creates the need. So having said that, we can then imagine what it would be like. And I think anybody out there who's camped a lot knows this feeling. What would it be like if you spent every night of your adult life alone camping under the stars? That each night your bed was a different place. One night it's the soft pine needles under a beautiful old pine on the edge of a cliff looking down on an amazing valley. You know, the next night it's in the soft grasses surrounded by fragrant flowers with the sky full of stars as your ceiling. You know, the next place it's a lush spring, you know, on the edge of a valley where in the morning the dawn chorus is so rich and beautiful that it just brings tears to your eyes, the sweetness of those sounds. You know, the next night you're by a gurgling brook, you know, and all night long you hear the songs of your ancestors and the drum beat of the rock rhythms. You know, you just think about that, how that would influence you. You know, and it's no wonder how people perceive Stalking Wolf. They said he was a drifter, you know, a homeless man who couldn't live indoors. And Stalking Wolf himself could not come into houses because he felt that they were sick, that there was something ill about the environment inside a house. He felt they were like prisons or cages. You know, but you can see where a person would develop that viewpoint if they spent all of their nights free under the stars. And even the rain, he loved and loved the rain. When the rain would fall on him, he would pause and look up like a little kid does today. You know, I watch little children who haven't been taught to fear the rain, how they just stand out there and just experience it and look up at it, and it lands on their eyelids, you know, and they're totally amazed at the sensation of the rain and how the scout learns to appreciate and love even the cold and the discomfort of the cold wind. That all these things become that man's experience or that woman's experience. They have to have that experience around them in order to feel alive. And that will help you to kind of get a perspective on these people. Because I know that after you've been camping for 5 or 6 days, how hard it is to come home, and how that first night back, even though it's nice to get a shower and to kind of feel the warmth, there's something funny about getting in a bedroom or getting into bed, you know. It just, something's not right. That's what you're feeling after a good long camping experience. There's just something to be said for living outdoors. So think about the patience of a scout. Think about the qualities that these people possessed. They were taught to stand still for really, really long periods of time. Sometimes hours standing in the shadows observing the landscape. Absolutely stone still. And in those times in my life when I've stood still for really long periods of time, that's when I've always seen the most. And we talk about the secret spot, and people think, well, what do I do when I get to my secret spot? And I can remember my first days at my secret spot, going out there and sitting by the tree, you know, and just fidgeting, essentially not knowing what to do, so kind of poking at the ground with a stick, you know, kind of looking around, you know, moving around, getting up, kind of sweeping off my butt again, sitting back down again, you know, oh, the stick's jabbing me in the leg, getting up, moving the stick, you know, and just fidgeting, you know. And I remember when I was sitting still waiting for some deer to come, and my friend was with me, and he observed, because he had been out sitting and watching deer for many, many years of his life, and he said to me, you know, what do you think any deer are going to come near you the way you fidget? They see you so far away, they see you long before you know they're even there, and they can tell that you're there. You have to learn to be like a statue. And that reminded me of all the things that I had heard growing up. Same thing, you know, just was cold up there in the tree. I didn't really feel like sitting, you know, it was too cold. I had to move around and stay warm. But you think about it, you know, fidgeting, it's just sort of the side effect of not being raised this way, you know. But if you really want to see, you have to learn to be like the scout. You know, they learn to imitate the animals, and they're taught to honor and appreciate the ability for a heron to sit perfectly still like a statue for so long. You know, and I like to watch the herons and You know, since I learned about herons, I watched them all the time and learned to imitate them, and they were my greatest teachers for stillness. Also, rattlesnakes. You know, the native lore about rattlesnakes, how the rattlesnake is part mountain and part living being, you know, that it can sit like a stone, perfectly still, not even breathing for hours if it chooses to, yet it's still alive. You know, and that particular state of mind is really honored and cherished in the Scout tradition, the ability to almost, you know, get so still that you're almost not there, you know, that you become part of and blending with the landscape around you. You know, it's the extreme of that state of mind we call the sacred silence, where you imagine yourself growing roots and the roots pushing down into the soil beneath you. You know, if you have a hard time sitting still, imagine yourself a stone, or imagine yourself an old mossy log, and really use your peripheral vision, your owl vision. Use all of your five senses at the same time to still your mind. And then you'll understand patience. And again, it comes down to need. You know, we say, okay, well, I got 45 minutes to go to my secret spot. I better go. Rush through the woods, you know, get to your secret spot. And all you're thinking about is, oh, I got 40 minutes left. Okay, I better enjoy myself. You know, and like your mind's busy and you start fidgeting and moving all around. And so you're at your secret spot for 40 minutes. And yes, you have some experience. Something better is going to happen than having not been there at all. But still, to capture the spirit of that scout, to be in total patience and total stillness, is really what you're after at that secret spot. You know, to enhance that, it pays to practice what we call a sense meditation. You know, to go into your wide-angle vision and at the same time hear the sounds around you 360 degrees, at the same time feeling the wind. Remember something that Jonathan Talbot said to me very recently, kind of reminded me of this, that he said when he first came to our school almost 5 years ago now, he had such a hard time achieving that stillness of mind that I'm talking about. And now after 5 years, he smiles to himself and thinks, wow, it's so great. I can just have that stillness of mind anytime I want. You know, it's just there all the time for me. What a big difference it makes. You know, how do we get it there? I mean, it's really hard to say what moment was the successful moment for Jonathan's mentoring, but it's all of this stuff that I'm telling you, practiced and practiced. You know, the need we created for him to practice, you know, to make sure he practices a sense meditation every day. The bird language gives you that incentive. So the willingness to go slow, to stop, to look, to listen, to watch, you know, that's part of this too. You know, I remember sometimes walking with Tom and it would take us 2.5 hours to go 100 yards, you know. And in our fast-paced life, we've been practicing always to get to the next place. You know, often we're pushing the envelope of time, you know, well, we have 5 minutes to get there. Let's stop here and get a quick coffee or something, and we'll push that 2-minute limit over, you know. Maybe we'll be 2 minutes late and that will still be tolerated, but we're always trying to steal from the moments around us because there's just so much to do. So we pattern on the need to move quickly everywhere we go to get there, you know. And what I'm telling you is that the scout patterns on the exact opposite. Patterns on, you know, I was just listening to Yoda last night talking to Luke Skywalker, saying you would never make a Jedi because your mind is always elsewhere. You're never thinking about where you're at. You're never fully present where you're at. And, you know, it's the same quality. The need to really be where you are and to appreciate every leaf and every bush, every tree around you, and to walk as if everything you're looking at, it's the first time you've ever seen it, you know, to be completely that idea of thankfulness. I was looking through the eyes of some native people not too long ago, and I was reflecting on some of the things that was being said and discussed in a conversation that was recorded a couple of hundred years ago from some hunter-gatherer nomads out on the plains here in this continent of North America. And they were discussing, as one of them was dying, he was talking about how much he loved every rock, every cloud, every grass blade around him, and how he didn't want to leave the earth. Even though he was mortally wounded and he was slipping out of his body, his friends stood around him and assured him that it would be okay for him to leave, that they would look after his family, He had been mortally wounded in combat. But the way that this man expressed love and appreciation for every element of life around him, he was so thoroughly familiar with every blade of grass, every rock, it was like he couldn't leave it because he loved it so much. He had gained that much familiarity with it, you know, in that scout tradition. You know, you want to think about it that way. So if it takes you 2.5 hours sometimes to get to your secret spot, you know, that's not a bad sign. That means you're beginning to assimilate some of these scout qualities. And especially in our children, those who have not yet chained themselves to mortgages and have not chained themselves to the commitments that need to be made, they're still the ones able to experience the fullness of what I'm talking about now. And as parents, as teachers, as mentors of the next generation, we should protect their childhood, not give them more things to do and not increase their load, you know, and say, well, you're on the soccer team and you do gymnastics at night and karate Friday night and dance and you have to do all your homework plus go to school, right? Now let's see what we can add to it. You know, why are we doing that to those poor people? You know, the child that's a child of the earth that loves nature, that wants to go to nature like I was as a child, and I think every child, if they had the opportunity, that child should be protected and encouraged to take 2.5 hours to get from here to there. Encouraged to live that life, to experience that, because they're the ones who will master this in the next generation. And I think about Greg Sommer over there and how this, I'm describing his weekly routine right now. He's probably sitting there thinking, gee, I thought everyone got to do this. How lucky you are, Greg. So, you know, that whole idea to go slow, to stop, to look, listen, and watch. If we think of the animals as our role models for a minute, I'm going to throw a little tracking language at you so you can catch up with this thought process here with me. My good friend Greg Winters was talking to a hunter who was successful at harvesting sort of what you might call record bucks on a regular basis. You know, he had the ability to know an ancient buck by its tracks, the ones with the really amazing antler racks. And he told Greg that the way he could tell was the way the footfalls were lying, you know, the way the front foot related to the rear foot in the track pattern. And he reckoned from watching animals make tracks, he figured out that, this animal was going a lot slower than the deer normally do. He figured that out from studying the animal's tracks, the way the feet, the rear feet related to the front feet. Okay? But what he said to Greg was, I think the reason they do that is because they're old and they're arthritic, so they can't walk as fast, so they can't quite get the same, you know, reach in their rear foot as a younger, more vital deer could. So they're always landing, you know, in a different manner that indicates slowness in their stride. And Greg came and said, John, what do you think of that? You know, he told me that because he knew I was a tracker. And I said, Greg, that gait that he's describing, you know what that is. You've taken my workshop on interpretive tracking enough to know that that is an indication that the animal is going slower than an animal normally would go in what we call the gathering information mode. And he said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. I said, yeah, that's how that buck lives to be old. It goes at half the speed that all the other animals in the forest go that are of the same species. You know, that's not a sign of arthritis. That's a scout quality. That animal has developed the mindset of a scout. It's moving at half the speed because it knows there is no hurry. You know, the hurry is what causes death. You know, if we reflect back on the adolescence thing that I talked about earlier in the tape series, that nature abhors adolescence, you know, it's classic information when you go to the deer check-in stations that I worked at as a college student. You know, as part of the wildlife science class I took, we had to work the deer check-in station. That is, after the hunters would shoot the deer, they have to bring them in to the check-in station to be tagged. And that was manned by fish and wildlife agents and college students who were fish and wildlife majors. And people in those classes. So I was at that station, and I worked with one wildlife agent, and we, in that one couple-hour period at sunset, we checked in 273 deer or something like that, and not one of them was older than 18 months. Every single one of those deer was 18 months or younger. And what that made me think, and what you might perceive from that is, oh, there's only 18-month-old deer in the forest. But what it really says is that those, the young, foolish deer, if you will, the ones that are sort of prone to make snap judgments and to move in a hurry, that adolescence energy is the easiest energy to take out of the landscape. And the kind of hunting that was going on that day, special permit day, you could shoot a deer of either sex with a shotgun in New Jersey. So it was kind of like carnage. You know, the hunters that were out there were more or less clay pigeon shooting deer. You know, these animals were running this way and that. The animals that were older and wiser knew enough to stay in cover and knew enough to move very slowly. And they probably eluded the hunters simply by hiding at their feet. You know, I looked at some deer tracks at one time that really taught me this lesson well. And I've heard this over and over again. The native people considered the deer, especially the black-tailed deer, to be a shapeshifter. They said that that animal was capable of turning into a salmonberry bush or into a mossy log. You know, those are the kind of legends that kids hear growing up. They learn to respect that animal's ability to elude and hide. And on this particular day, I was walking with a group of students, and we came over a hill in a beech forest. And I was right up front with one of the other students, and we looked out over the landscape to see four or five white-tailed deer bounding away from us down the hill. And we had such a great view of it. They went straight into a thicket that was choked with this vine called greenbrier that was protecting a spring. There was spice bushes and elderberry. And there was, as a matter of fact, it was the same. It was the upper end of that wetland that I described yesterday where the Yellowthroat Club story took place. So it was the upper end of that where it was still in the forest. So it was a natural greenway that led into a big swamp. So the deer went straight into that thicket. We watched the trajectory that they were on. We saw what direction they were going in. And we saw the hedge that they went into. And on all sides of it, it was surrounded by open forest. You could see all around it. So what happened after that was, I said to the students, I said, how would you guys like to see these deer up close and personal? And they said, oh yeah, we'd love to, you know. So we lined them all up. And we went straight down into that thicket, far below where the deer were hiding. So if you can picture this, the deer were kind of like hiding in the cul-de-sac of this green belt. You know, it was like the last finger of this creek that ended in a spring, or I should say the creek began right there. So there was like an arm of greenery that represented the little creek that was flowing, and it ended, and it was surrounded on three sides by what was sort of like a stadium-shaped hill arrangement of open forest. You know, you could see all over the place in there. There was no brush layer. There was just tall, mature oaks and beech trees. So you had a good view all the way up to the pine forest on the hill. So my thinking was, let's move right down and cut them off and keep them in that green belt, and we'll walk in a drag line, you know, so many feet apart until we push them out of the end of it, and then we'll watch them run up that hill into the pine forest. And that was my thinking. So I didn't really know what I was up against. So we lined up, kind of almost held hands, and walked up that wetland and quote-unquote pushed the deer out the end, and they were supposed to squirt up. And you know, the tension was building as we got closer and closer to the end of this finger of greenery, and it was only like 10 yards left of it. You know, we're like, oh my God, any minute, man, they're really in there, and they're going to be pressured, and they're going to explode out. And there was like all this tension building, and we got within 10 feet of the end of it, 5 feet, and then we passed the end of it, and there was no deer. So all those students who hadn't seen the deer thought that me and the guy up front were pulling their legs, and that this was just, you know, like a prank that we were playing on them. And they didn't really believe us. And I just stood there and scratched my head, and I said, where'd they go? You know, like, what happened? I mean, I know I saw a deer go into that thicket, you know, I'm just totally amazed. So I got down on my hands and knees and started crawling down the interior of that thicket, right where the raccoons crawl along that little creek. And down the raccoon trail, and I mean a raccoon trail, so I was being scratched on my shoulders as I went through there by greenbriars. They were yanking at my clothes. I found the tracks of deer bellies, deer knees, deer hooves as they literally crawled in their bellies right past us. They went right in between us as we were walking upstream, and they crawled in the opposite direction on their bellies for about 25 yards to elude us. You know, and that kind of gives you some insight for a moment. Elk have been known to do the same kinds of things. I know this particular black-tailed deer that lives in western Washington lives right next to a road during hunting season and just lives on its belly in a blackberry thicket. And that's how it makes it. So these animals, especially the old wise ones, are like the scouts themselves. And so to learn to move with the stillness and the silence and the slowness of a scout is to imitate that ancient buck. You got to think about what that ancient buck must experience, you know? You got to think about the different levels of experience of people who go in a forest. From the one extreme, the profile of the person who doesn't even believe there is such a thing as bird language, to the other extreme, the ancient buck, who moves so slow and so still and who watches everything, walking five steps at a time, listening, looking around, eating very carefully, taking its time, living in the sacred silence. And that's very, very important to this. Okay, and I'll make a point about energy conservation in a second here that'll help you to understand this. So at this time, I would also like to introduce an experience I had a couple years back at a class that we taught called The Language of the Birds. It was a weekend workshop where we actually made people go out to their secret spots several times a day and come back and map the results of their experience, and I facilitated that. I had a helper with me. It was Greg Summer that day. And I had just been, a couple of days before, talking to a group of people who were bird watchers about bird language, and I had a few people in that group who absolutely did not believe that bird language was a possibility. You know, they were absolutely, they had been doing it for so long that they knew that I couldn't be right, you know, and they were really, really kind of arrogant with me about it too, and I wasn't going to push it. You know, I just sort of listened to them nicely, nodded my head, and just kind of shrugged my shoulders, like, what do you do in a case like that, you know? And it kind of brings back my mind to the whole question that I was asked early about, you know, the soft science versus the hard science approach to this whole thing. Those people were really sort of hard science, you know, you've got to show me, you've got to prove it to me. But there's this really interesting twist that goes on there. Remember, we talk about invisibility as not only a function of your mechanical behavior, but it's also a function of your mental behavior and how thanksgiving as an attitude creates invisibility. Well, the whole idea that you need to prove something in order for it to be believed is the opposite of the phenomenon of thanksgiving. You know, do you realize that? So it's like this catch-22. If you're a person who says, you have to prove it to me, show me, you're going to have the very opposite experience of the scout who goes in there knowing that this is true and goes in with total humility. You know, and I'm reminded of that because I had had such a paradoxical experience going from those bird watchers who were so sure I was wrong about bird language to the very next day being in the forest with Greg Summer, who I asked him, Greg, would you please take on the mindset of a hunting animal and walk all around their secret spots while they're out there. They don't know you're doing this. And do this for me and stay out of sight so they can't see you, and don't make any noise if you can so they can't figure out you're a human. And please just try to create bird alarms as you go around, you know. And Greg said, okay, John, sure, no problem, you know, because Greg, at that age, I think you were 15 at the time, basically he didn't know he wasn't supposed to be able to do that. So he went right out there and imitated a wolverine or something. I can't remember what you used, but
yeah, wolverine and kind of velociraptor.
So he's creating a mindset of this really intense hunting predator. And as he moved through the forest around all their secret spots, the Steller's jays just followed him and called at him, and you know, were blaming him for being a sneak the whole way around. You know, so here's this 15-year-old walking the Steller's jays. You know, the very next day, after these people who had been out in the woods for so many years told me that it wasn't possible, you know, that this kind of thing wasn't possible. So, you know, I have to bring this up because I want you to think about the extremes of perception that are out there between the world of the native scout and the world of people who have a very sort of hard science approach to this. So in saying that, I'm going to wrap up this little story here about the scouts by reflecting back on the deer again for a second. The idea of kind of capturing the spirit of that old buck, you know, that there is the possibility for you to have that experience, and it's just a matter of imitation, you know, but that eventually what has to happen is your mind has to achieve that silence of mind and that stillness of mind that the buck achieves, and that's only going to be accomplished through time. So don't be impatient with yourself. Don't give up on yourself, and certainly don't let your children give up. This kind of experience takes time. It has to be nurtured. You know, it has to be practiced. You know, you have to create the need for yourself or for your children in order for them to do this. The best way to do that is to tell them cool stories, and tell them, when I was your age, I used to sneak around in the woods and, you know, where there's this ancient buck that lives on the hill and that sort of thing, you know, and get the mystique going, because it's true. It is true. You might say there's an ancient buck that lives on the hill and think that you're not telling the truth, and only to your amazing delight and surprise, you know, you go out there and start imitating that buck, and one day you actually see it. Okay, so, you know, you have to, again, remember all the things that I've told you. The last piece of this is the need for empathy, the need to capture the feeling. You know, what is that song sparrow feeling over there? You know, try to put yourself in that song sparrow's position, thinking about the fact that you own, quote unquote, or maybe we should look at it this way, you rent for the season. You have a spring rental, you know, that quarter acre patch of grass, brush, hedges, and trees. And in that quarter acre, you have to make all your family's needs possible. You have to keep other song sparrows out of it who are competing for the same food as you. You have to raise your young and feed them, and you have to know all of the hiding places that you can hide in the event of the approach of a sharp-shinned hawk. You have to know the game trails of the predators that move through. You have to be able to anticipate and know all of the dangers that might come at you from all sides, above and all 360 degrees around you, and also from below you, the snakes and the things that crawl up into the brush. So you have to know an awful lot in order to be successful. And you have to hold that place and guard it and protect it with all of your life energy. You know? So if you can, you yourself as a human being, can imagine that investment and imagine what that place means to that song sparrow, it's easier for you then to understand what that song sparrow is feeling. Not necessarily thinking, but what it's feeling. You will be very quick to pick up on the fact that just like listening to music, you don't even have to know what the words mean of a song. Like maybe the song is in Spanish or Italian or something, and you don't speak that language, but you're listening to it, you can tell that it's a sad song, or you can tell that it's a love song, or you can tell that it's a happy song. You don't really need to know what the words are in order to be able to do that. In the same way, you don't need to know exactly what that bird is saying to know what it's feeling. You pick up on the empathy. And it's to the point now where I can't be near robins when they're screaming about a crow in their territory. I have to go over and chase the crow away because it is so incredibly intense, the feeling I get from those parents panicking about their child being hurt. It's just such an intense feeling that I can feel it in my body. And it's something that I have to respond to. It just drives me nuts. I can't just stand there. And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. I don't speak robin. You know, I can't, you know, translate, you know, verses of Robin into English for you, but I can recognize the feeling that that animal is having, just like you could, and that's what you're going to begin to pick up. So imagine putting all of this together, that kind of empathy, that kind of awareness, and that kind of knowledge of place that the scout possesses, and carry all that knowledge into every situation with you. And you'll begin to understand what's possible with the language of the birds. So on the other side, we're going to continue our stories from native lore, and we're going to explore some other examples from native people, and look forward to continuing.